is the fact that you spend so much time trying to get policy bills for the first deadline, maybe the second deadline, then all of a sudden you got 1 week to put your budget bills together. And so that's kind of backwards because the budget is the one thing we have to do.
Like Lane said.
So he took the view that, you know, why don't we just do the budget stuff first and then
a wonderful group.
Come back after Easter and finish up the policy bills. Well, you know.
Senator Bach and I felt that given schedules, both of people to testify as well as committee members, it might be easiest to have a joint meeting of the tax and the finance committees to hear a discussion of yesterday's forecast, where we are and where we're going. And so appreciate the triumvirate of Commissioner Hansen, Dr. Stinson, Mr. Showalter being available to speak with us. So I'm not sure how the three of you would like to proceed. Do you want to all come to the table and just, you know, Commissioner, are you going to start? Or
yes.
And I think members have the highlights of the budget forecast as well as some other information. Okay. So, Commissioner Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Tom Hansen, Commissioner of Finance. And as you said, I believe you have the highlights and then a copy of the slide presentation that we will be referring to. We'll start on page one. You will see, referring to the slide on the bottom of page one, 2006-2007, of course, the biennium that we're in, that we're ending this summer, that started with such turmoil a few years ago in 2005 when we stayed here practically all summer and we're trying to find ways to find revenue and trying to get our session done. And in the end, with the February forecast, we end that biennium with $1,013,000,000. If only we had known that 2 years ago, we all would have had a little more time in the summer 2 years ago. You will see that the change from the November forecast is fairly small. It is down $25 million. That includes the $24 million bill that Senator Bach, you passed, Mr. Chairman, and Representative Lincheski, that's $24 million. The rest of the changes that you see there are fairly minor. As you turn to the second page, at the top of the second page of the slides, the $1,013,000,000 carries over into the 2008-2009 biennium for a $2.163 billion balance. That is a $7 million change from the November forecast. And as we said yesterday, that is fairly close for forecasting. A couple of changes to note. In the change column, the revenues were up $160 million. And you may want to talk a little more about that. Dr. Stinson will give a little more detail on that in a minute. But essentially, the 160 is $153 million of corporate income tax. That's an increase. And sales tax was down, reflecting lower fourth quarter sales in 2006, down $53 million. And then the spending is up primarily $142 million, which is primarily hospital rebasing at $91 million. The other thing to note of the $2.163 billion that $1 billion of that would be inflation. So if you were to carry forward the same package of decisions from the 2006-2007 biennium, it would be $1 billion of that, of the 2.16 would be to do just that. Or to look at it another way, if we were to turn the clock back to prior to the 2002 session in which we changed the statute and counting inflation in the forecast, that 2.163 would be 1.163. And we would have an extra chart or two in the back of the forecast book applying the CPI rate to the various levels, various spending levels.
So, Commissioner, Mr. Chairman, is it true then that if we had been counting inflation, the only money we would have in this budget forecast is the one-time money left, that there'd be really no ongoing money that we might call a surplus.
That would be one way of looking at it, yes. As you look at the chart on the bottom of page 2, we're looking ahead to the planning estimates of 2010 and 2011. And remember, the planning estimates are based on the budget we passed in 2005 and amended in 2006 and carried forward all the way that far. So that's quite a ways to forecast. But you will see that corporate revenues, revenues are down $286 million, primarily to corporate revenues falling off in 2010 and 2011. And then we have an increase in spending of $132 million, which is essentially the hospital rebasing carried forward and ramping up in the 2010-2011 biennium. You see that's a total of $418 million less in 2010 and 2011 than what we had projected in the November forecast. And then also you see the CPI rate. That would add another, the February forecast adds inflation, adds to the CPI rate in 10 and 11 for an increase of $220 million. With that, I will turn it over to Dr. Stinson, who will start at the top of page 3.
Dr. Stinson. Mr. Chairman, I'm Tom Stinson. I'm a state economist. I'm also a professor at the University of Minnesota. The message, as I'm sure you're all well aware, is that we've had very small changes in the outlook for revenues for the 2007, 2008, 2009, 2010 and 2011 fiscal years. For 2006 and 2007, the revenue outlook has changed by $34 million, or a tenth of a percent. For 2008, 2009, it's changed by $160 million, or about a half a percent. It's tempting to believe that, given the record of forecasting for the last few years, that we somehow have control over the economy, that we somehow are able to predict what revenues are going to be. And it's just not true that we're in an unusual situation here where the economy hasn't changed very much compared to what the forecast was. There haven't been any major tax law changes that have complicated the forecasting process, and things have gone well. But this is well within the normal range of change. We'd expect somewhere in the 3 to 4 percent difference to be a normal situation. So the reason for my saying this is really that there is still considerable downside risk and considerable upside potential, both on these revenues, that we're just not in November going to be as accurate as this appears. The second point to make is that the 2008-2009 forecast is a forecast. We haven't received any of that money. We won't receive any of that money until July 1 of 2007, and a lot of things can change before we get the first dollar of that money. Looking in a little more detail at the forecast, almost all of the changes in the forecast were due to technical changes. For example, the income tax in 2006-2007 was reduced by $22 million to reflect the law change that was done at the start of this session. And so these are all very small changes. There's just been a very small change in income by source. When we got the sample for tax year 2005 returns, the percentage changes for the various classes of income were, in general, so close that to what we had put into the model in November that we had to just make very tiny adjustments to them. This is just a very unusual situation here that we've had. Since the start of the year, the income tax has been a little bit weak, and that was reflected in the forecast. We took $10 million out of withholding during the first quarter, and the withholding forecast just to reflect that weakness. We'll find out later today how we're doing compared to what the forecast is, because we always compile all our information at the end of the month, and yesterday was the end of the month. But at this point, it doesn't look like there are any particular problems. We took a quick glimpse of it last night. On the sales tax, it's down $18 million in fiscal 06-07, $53 million in fiscal 08-09. Those are very small changes, again, on a percentage basis, 0.2%, 0.6%. The issue here, the cause of this almost entirely, is that in the fourth quarter of 2006, we got less money than we had expected. And so since we forecast the fourth quarter of 2007 by starting with the using as a base the fourth quarter of 2006 and then having a percent change on that, that lowered the base by $13 million, and that then carries forward. The question as to why the sales tax is underperforming, and it's underperforming just a little bit, not a lot, but just a little bit, but why the sales tax would be underperforming given that we had quite a low growth rate already in the forecast, and given what you hear that consumer spending in the fourth quarter wasn't down. I mean, even after the GDP revisions yesterday, it was still relatively strong. Just seems to get to what we're taxing as part of the sales tax base in Minnesota. We're always interested in knowing what happened to Christmas sales, and we're curious whether the sales, Christmas sales, were weighted toward clothing or electronics, clothing being not taxable, electronics being taxable. Turns out that this year, from all we've seen, that this was not a clothing gift Christmas. This was a gift of taxable items, and yet we still didn't make the forecast. And so given the growth that we had, it must indicate that services are becoming an even larger part of the consumption base that we have there, and it raises questions about the longer term aspects of Minnesota's sales tax base, that if consumer services, if household services are getting to be a larger and larger proportion of the sales tax base, then we're going to see less growth in the sales tax than we have historically. On the corporate income tax, the corporate income tax is up a combined $223 million over 06-07, 08-09 from November's forecast. It's due entirely to stronger profits, stronger corporate profits than we had in the November forecast. We still believe that looking out, the corporate profit outlook is too strong, and we'll talk about that a little bit in a minute. That's the numbers that we have in there at this point. Other things are not particularly other taxes didn't. There weren't any big changes. The insurance gross premium tax was the largest downer of that. Bottom line is that these are extremely small changes in the forecast, even for the change in the forecast between February and November. And while we would like to think we would be right on, this is as close to having no change as we could possibly be. Part of the reason why there's no change in the forecast is because there was almost no change in the economy. If you look at the bottom of page 3, you can see how the economic outlook for real or inflation-adjusted GDP changed. The black bars are the February bars. The lighter colored bars are the November bars. What you can see is that the second half of 2006, the economic growth was raised in the forecast to reflect actual data that had been released. What we found out yesterday was that that was not accurate, that the Bureau of Economic Analysis of the U.S. Department of Commerce revised their data and took 1.2% out of the growth rate. So if you were to adjust that to what we know today, that black bar that is at the 2.5% level drops back down to the 2% level, 2.1% level there. At that point, then, it's really just a wash. You have a little bit more early, a little bit less in 2008 and 2009 going on. There doesn't appear to be any reason at this point for Global Insight to change their forecast materially for 2008 and 2009. They'll still, I think, in March be in a situation where they have around 3% real growth, have slower growth during 2007. The last 2 days, there's been disturbing news and then a little bit of reassuring news on the stock market. The stock market fell substantially on Tuesday. Yesterday, it was up 40 points or 50 points, recovered about a tenth of what it had lost. That's certainly a problem for individual portfolios. To the extent that you were invested in the stock market, you've lost money. However, this isn't necessarily a sign that the U.S. economy is stumbling or anything like that. We can easily spin scare scenarios that would say that this is the start of something big, a big downturn, but it could also just be one of these occasional blips in the stock market that occurs. And so until there's a lot more information, I don't think that we'll take much out of that one way or the other. The real issue remains one of what's going to happen to the housing industry in the country. And if you turn the page, look at the bottom of page 4. You can see what's happened to U.S. single-family housing starts over the last year. They've gone from about 1.75 million per year, seasonally adjusted rate, down to 1.22 by the end of the year, so they've lost about a third. The January number would be 1.1 million, so they've lost 600,000 housing starts over the year. Yesterday, some new numbers came out on new home sales, and we want to kind of keep these numbers in parallel or be thinking about them. In this way, remember I said that in January, on a seasonally adjusted basis, we had 1.1 million starts. Yesterday, new home sales in the month of January were 937,000. So instead of working down the inventory, the excess inventory that's hanging over the system, what we have is we have a situation where the inventory was actually added to a little bit. We need to be actually seeing new home sales greater than the starts, and one of the problems with the sales numbers is that they're never adjusted for people who drop the contract. And so new home sales, 937,000, but lately we've seen substantial numbers of people first committing to the sale and then saying, no, I've decided I'm not going to buy that house later, after, you know, afterwards, after a month or two. And so this is not a particularly good piece of good news that we have here. It doesn't look like the balance between inventories and construction has been is moving in the right direction at this. Now, January is a small month, and you can have seasonal adjustment problems in there. But still, this is not the kind of news that you would want to hear if you're thinking about what's going on in the housing industry. For Minnesota, at the top of page 5, if anything, the situation in Minnesota has been worse. This is a graph that shows what's happened to single-family housing permits. This is Minnesota-specific data. It shows we've gone from about 2,500 starts per, or permits per month. This is a monthly figure in the first part of 2006, down to a little bit under 1,500 starts per, or permits per month by the end of the year. In our forecast, we have that leveling off and then starting to go back up again by the start of 2008. The concern that we have, and we debated it, my staff and I debated this quite a bit, is whether that's not too optimistic. The reason why we have it in there is because we fell so far so fast that we thought maybe we were a little bit ahead of the national curve. But you can easily make the argument that instead of starting to recover later in the summer, that what happens is that August and September, people say, well, the inventory situation is getting a little bit better under control, but I'm just not going to start until next spring and write off the whole year. So we're very concerned about this. We think the housing situation is a little more serious in Minnesota than it is nationally, in part because of the state's lumber and wood products industry. We have in the forecast we're going to lose about 12,000 jobs in the construction industry, but we have losing about 1,700 jobs in the lumber and wood products industry. Some of those jobs have already been lost. Right after we issued the November forecast, Anderson Windows, for example, announced that they were laying off 450 people. So that's something that is already built into the forecast. But it is a concern. That's the place where we're concerned about the Minnesota economy. And unfortunately, given the weather patterns that we have, this isn't something that we're going to know very much about until really May or June, in terms of how the housing construction industry is responding in the state of Minnesota. We have a couple of concerns that are the same concerns that we had in November that we talked about after the November forecast. The first is that the outlook for corporate profits provided by Global Insight, our national forecast consultant, seems to be unduly rosy, and that we're concerned that for a couple of reasons that I'll go into in a minute, that this may be, following their scenario, might put us in a position where we face some reasonably substantial drops in revenue by the end of the 2008-2009 biennium, even if the economy was performing more or less as we thought it would. Concern is demonstrated in the graph at the bottom of page 5. If you look at this, what you see is that corporate profits as a percentage of GDP for the last couple of quarters have been at almost an all-time high only the fourth quarter of 1950 were they as high as a percentage of GDP as in the last couple of quarters. Those are actual data that's coming from the U.S. Department of Commerce, but that data can be revised a lot because the corporate income tax filings that are used to determine what corporate profits actually are don't show up for the U.S. Department of Commerce for several years. And so what you see is you see a history where they have these numbers in there, but then there are big revisions several years later after the corporate income tax returns show up and they can analyze it. For forecast purposes, Global Insight and all the other macroeconomic forecasters use corporate profits as a balancing item. You have to have the national income accounts and the national product accounts balance, and so they estimate all the elements of the national product accounts. They estimate all the elements using statistical equations for all the elements of the national income accounts except for corporate profits, and then they make the two accounts balance by adjusting corporate profits however that needs to be adjusted. That creates a situation where you can have big fluctuations from forecast to forecast simply because of errors in your other estimating equations. Given all this, we're concerned that we would be putting too much emphasis on corporate profits, and so what we've done is follow what the Congressional Budget Office has done, and that's use a different model, and we're looking down, we're driving corporate profits as a percentage of GDP down to 10% by 2010. The dotted line, or the circles in the graph on the bottom of page 5 shows you what the path is. Now, looks like that's a pretty steep path for decline in corporate profits, but you'll notice it still puts us at a level above anything we'd been prior to or up since the late 1970s, early 1980s for the entire forecast horizon. The other thing that I want to point out, I guess, on this is that part of the reason for Chairman Greenspan's concern that set off the Shanghai stock market and everything else, if you read the entire story, is he said that corporate profits appear to be, the growth in profits appears to be over, or words to that effect. That's one of the early signs of a weakening economy. So Chairman Greenspan's basically saying that he doesn't think corporate profits are going to grow at the same rate as we've seen in the last few years as well. Final point that I want to make.
Senator
Dr. Stinson, before we turn the page, I'm looking back at the single housing permits. I'm wondering about the, I think in 2006 I read something about the U.S. savings rate of individuals. We actually had a negative rate, and that causes me some concern. Would we have any information on what the savings rate is of individuals in Minnesota? I'm wondering, looking at the housing chart, I'm wondering if people aren't investing in housing, does that mean they might be saving more money?
Mr. Chairman, the savings rate is not well measured. The U.S. savings rate is not well measured, and while we could come up, I believe, with a very similar measure for Minnesota, it might actually be a very interesting thing to take a look at to see what the Minnesota savings rate would be. It would not be well measured either. And here's the problem. The problem is this, that the way that the U.S. savings rate is calculated is you take after-tax income and you take personal consumption spending, okay, two different measures, and if and the difference between after-tax income and personal consumption spending is the change in savings, okay? Now, a simple example is, say that you have some stock that you had a capital gain on. Okay, it's gone up in value. You sell that stock. You pay capital gains tax on it. That tax bill is deducted from your current income, not from the income that you received from the sale of the stock. So that depresses your current income. You just put that money, you don't spend that money, you just put that money back into the stock market and buy something else with it or something like that. That causes the savings rate actually to decline. The savings rate doesn't include internal buildup of things like in your 401k or your IRA or anything like that. It doesn't include the appreciation in your stock market account that if you don't realize it. So it's not a really good measure. It's not kind of what the normal person would think of as savings. It's still an interesting question, though. When you said that, I thought, God, you could do that, I think, for Minnesota and take a look at it. So we might take a look at that just out of curiosity.
Thank you.
Turning to the top of page 6, just want to remind you again of something that we reminded you of in the November forecast, and that is under current federal tax law, the capital gains tax rate is scheduled to increase from 15% to 20% at the end of 2010. Now, what that means for the individual investor is that if you were going to sell your some stock on January 15th of 2011, you'd likely say, wait a minute, I'll only pay 15% tax rate instead of 20% tax rate if I sell it in December. And so you'd accelerate that purchase. In the past, we've seen pretty substantial acceleration in the year before a tax increase. If you look back on that graph to 1986, you see that capital gains actually more than doubled between 85 and 86. And then in 87, it fell substantially, and actually capital gains didn't get back up to the 85 level until 95. Well, the same kind of a thing is likely to happen between 2010 and 2011 tax years, but this is 2011 and 2012 fiscal years because the effect on payments wouldn't show up until the next April 15th. We look at this and we see some for Minnesota somewhere between $300 and $500 million. In the forecast, it's $327 million. But, of course, that number can change pretty dramatically depending on what the stock market does between now and then. Somewhere between $300 and $500 million increase in revenues for tax year 2011. And then a similar decline in fiscal year 2012, which isn't part of the forecast horizon. Now, it's important to realize that we're talking about not going back to the level in there. We're talking about a $600 to $1 billion swing because we added $300 million to the base in fiscal year 2011, we'll subtract $300 million from the base in fiscal year 12. So that's a $600 million swing, not a $300 million swing. If you look at the dotted line, it shows what would be likely to happen there. You can see the magnitude of that line compared to the magnitude of the capital gains losses that we had in 2001 and 2002, and you can see that actually it dwarfs them by quite a bit. And so you all remember, or most of you remember, that we had a lot of problem with revenues in 2001 and 2002 because of capital gains. Well, this is something that's just sitting out there.
Dr. Stinson, so we're assuming that those lower capital gains taxes are going to sunset. So if Congress were to act and extend those lower capital gains taxes, would our revenue then shrink even more in 10 and 11?
Mr. Chairman, if Congress extends the capital gains tax rate, in fiscal 10, it probably wouldn't have any impact, but in fiscal 11, it'd take that peak off of there. We'd subtract 300, 400, whatever the appropriate number is at the time, but from this forecast, we'd subtract $327 million from that forecast for fiscal 2011.
So the 418 revenue deviation from November, if Congress were to act, would become 700 and something?
That's correct.
Thank you.
Okay. If there are no other questions, let me turn it over to
Mr. Chairman.
Yesterday at the forecast, I asked kind of a broad question about the direction of the economy. Maybe we could get into a little more detail. If you look at what you've presented and comparing Minnesota's economy to the national economy, first let me ask, what I inferred from the discussion yesterday was a continuation of a concern you've raised over the last several years, and that is that whereas historically Minnesota's economy outperformed the national economy, now it seems that we're in an era over the last two or three years and based on forecast over the next arguably several years where we are at the very least even with the national economy, if in some ways running behind the national economy. Is that a fair generalization?
Mr. Chairman, that is a fair generalization. When I go to New York to talk to bond rating agencies, and something I've done for a number of years, it's always been a pleasant task because you can point to how Minnesota's doing better than the U.S. economy. Minnesota did better in this way. Minnesota did better in this way. Minnesota did better in this way. In the last few years, it's not been as pleasant a task because we've had to explain why Minnesota's economy isn't generating the kind of job growth that we would have expected and that would be consistent with the U.S. economy. More recently, we've had some problems with personal income growth in this state, that it hasn't grown as fast as the U.S. economy. Now, sometimes there are obvious data problems with the U.S. numbers, and they get fixed, and sometimes U.S. numbers get revised down and come closer to Minnesota's economy. But all those things taken into account, Minnesota's economy over the last few years hasn't performed as well as the national economy, and it's something that's of concern in the revenue forecast, obviously, but it's something of broader concern for the state.
Dr. Simpson, if you could specify two or three of the reasons for that, and what should we, if the legislature can do anything relative to that, what should we be doing, and what do you see over the next several years then as to what, separate from legislative action, what kind of opportunities there might be for corrections, if there are any?
Mr. Chairman, it's very hard to do something in the short term to help a state's economy. So that, you know, a lot of what has happened in terms of Minnesota's economy is something that the foundation was laid years and years and years ago in terms of wise investments made by the state back in the 1950s and 1960s. One of the concerns that we have at this point is that what may be going on is that there's been a change in the structure of where the growth comes from in the U.S. economy. Minnesota is not a state that has a great deal of defense production, defense contracting. That's something that we're not very well positioned in. And to the extent that over the last 5 or 6 years, the defense budget and defense issues in general have grown more important, places that are centers of defense contracting have grown faster than the rest of the country. And so that's one of the issues, and that's something that is just a structural change that we're not going to be able to do much about in there. Okay. Another change that we certainly have to be aware of is the globalization. And globalization is not bad. It provides benefits, but it provides differential benefits depending upon how well situated you are compared to the demand for products internationally and you know, what you're producing. If you look at what's going on globally, to the extent that you're producing consumer products, you're not going to be able to compete probably globally. What you have to be thinking about, and to the state's credit, we are thinking about our high-tech things like medical devices, those kinds of things, the development that goes on, machine tools, things that make consumer products rather than things that are consumer products in there. The markets in China and Asia for consumer products that everybody looks at, those aren't going to be markets that are going to be filled with U.S.-produced goods. Those are going to be markets that are going to be filled with goods that are produced in Asia, in part because of the transportation cost. That U.S. producers of T-shirts for Asia, for example, not only have to compete with the low-wage labor that's there, they also have to ship. They have the shipping costs as well that provide a disadvantage. And so we're in a changing structure, changing economic structure. So that's those are some things. One of the things that the state demographer and I have great concern about, looking at the performance of the Minnesota economy and what the what's gone on, is that if you look back and then the record for the Minnesota economy is as follows. In the 1960s, we were at about 95% of the U.S. average in terms of per capita personal income. We ranked 25th among all states. Today, we're 108, 109% of the U.S. average, and we rank 8th or 9th among all states. So this is a pretty amazing transformation, pretty amazing growth that we had in the Minnesota economy over that 40 or 50-year period. One of the things that if you look at what the workforce looked like in the 1960s, a little less than half of the workforce had a high school degree in the 1960s. Today, roughly 90% of the workforce has a high school degree. Now, it's not to say that there weren't a lot of reasons why the workforce didn't have a high school degree. These are people that had come out of the Depression when you needed to work to stay alive for your family, to have enough to go on. People that had been in the war and come out of the war and didn't have a high school degree. But still, the quality of the workforce, the education of the workforce has changed dramatically. If you look at what's happening to the workforce now, and what's happening to people entering the workforce now, we actually have a very good reputation or record nationally in terms of the high school graduation rate. But even for the white majority students, the high school graduation rate isn't quite enough to match up with the high school graduation rate of the existing workforce. So we're in the 90s in the existing workforce, we're in the high 80s for the white majority students. And so we're losing this quality of education. We're losing this quality of workforce battle. And that's a concern for us. And so working, figuring out some way of dealing with that, that's going to be a real challenge. Figuring out ways of dealing with the retirement of the workforce and the fact that you're going to lose a lot of highly skilled people to retirement, and you're going to have a need to replace them. How do you somehow make that up? And are there ways that through public and private action that you can encourage different work arrangements and things like that? Those are going to be the kind of challenges that you need to think about.
Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Stinson, you talked about research and education, and you know, biotechnology is pretty important things for us to think about in the future. How big a factor is the energy that we import? And if we're able to pull off this renewable energy biofuels initiative, so we're actually making energy, so it is opposed to importing, could that be in our, how big a factor is that in Minnesota's economy in our long term?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Skoy, certainly going to be important. Anything that creates good jobs is going to be important to the long-range economic outlook for Minnesota, and the jobs that are going to be created in the energy, alternative energy area will be good jobs. And so that's certainly important. In the large scale of things, it's going to be around the edges, though. It's not going to be the thing that really turns the state around or anything like that. You know, we're not going to be the Kuwait of bioenergy conversion or anything like that, because we don't have that much land that we can devote to it. So it's important, but it's not the only thing, and it's not the big thing. The big thing continues to have to be the quality of the Minnesota workforce. That's the place where we have, that's our advantage right now. We have an international reputation for having very high quality workers. The brand identification for Minnesota workforce is very strong. We've got to be sure that we retain that brand identification and build the quality of that brand, that reputation. That's the thing that we're going to have to worry about.
Mr. Chairman, Dr. Stinson, I'd like to talk for just a second about the motor vehicle sales tax. You know, we read in the media that all three of the major American automobile companies are in difficulty, with a Ford plant is closed here in St. Paul. Are consumers backing off of buying automobiles, or is just a shift from American automobiles to foreign? Or do you have any information on that?
The record for the motor vehicle sales tax for the last few years has been one of being too optimistic and then ratcheting it down, being still too optimistic and ratcheting it down and being still too optimistic. It may be premature to say this, but there are at least signs that the great American love affair with the automobile is waning. A few years ago, actually 6 years ago, I was at a conference, and a woman from who worked for Global Insight was talking about the outlook for the motor vehicle sales, and she said, "Really, it's gotten to be that automobiles are almost seen as a fashion accessory. That you have a blue one to drive with certain outfits, you have a red one to drive with certain outfits, and so on like that." And she thought that this was getting to the point where it was ridiculous, and we would begin to drop back and have more kind of normal behavior in terms of the number of cars per person and things like that. It appears that that's part of what's going on here with the motor vehicle sales tax, is that we're not only seeing a little bit of change because of demographics, but we're also just seeing a ratcheting back of demand for automobiles because we aren't going to have quite as many. And then the other thing that's obviously happening is that the quality of automobiles is lasting. I know, you know, you're almost as old as I am probably, and you know how the quality of automobiles has improved over our life, our driving lifetime, and so it's there are all those factors in there. And you know, if you look out, you're going to see automobile sales continue, but we don't think they're going to be continuing at the same kind of rates that we saw. And part of it is just that the dropping of the incentive programs, the reduction in the incentive programs, makes cars a little bit more expensive, and if they're a little bit more expensive, you buy fewer of them.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Dr. Stinson. I'm wondering if you can expand a little bit about your comments about globalization, that Minnesota's economy is behind the national economy for at least one of two reasons, one of them being globalization. And in particular, you talked about how we're not going to sell our consumer products overseas. The types of things we can do and could encourage to have that growth would be to encourage the licensing and the harvesting of intellectual property and manufacturing overseas and generating foreign royalties and things like that, manufacturing. Can you comment just a little bit about that? And if I'm heading in the right direction with my thinking about that, that could be encouraged and our Minnesota economy might recover and grow even more as an aspect of the overall picture?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ortman, I don't want to be too pessimistic about Minnesota compared to the U.S. economy in terms of the prospects for selling consumer goods overseas. I don't think that the U.S. economy is going to sell consumer goods overseas. Minnesota is part of the U.S. economy, so you know, it's just not there's not a competitive advantage in it. I think that really what we have to do is we have to be thinking about, and this is no big surprise, but you know, thinking about very small, high-valued products like pacemakers, like heart valves, things like that, where the transportation cost is incidental to the cost of the product, and where quality reputation is very important. I've said this before, and you may have even heard me say this before, but if you're faced with a choice between buying a pacemaker from Medtronic and buying a Joe's pacemaker, you know, $500 price difference isn't going to convince you to buy Joe's probably in there. And so this quality reputation is really important. A company in Minnesota has some technology, competes in a global market in a very competitive environment, disc drive suspension, because they have such a reputation for quality. That Dell Computer knows that if they buy Hutchinson Technology disc drive suspensions, that they are going to have fewer upset customers with them because of disc drive failure than they would if they were buying from someone else. And so this quality issue is really important. The other issue I think that is important and we need to be thinking as a state about is new products and where do we get the ideas and the activity for new products. And here, part of that comes from basic research, not research done at 3M, which is important, or at Medtronic or so on like that, but research done at the University of Minnesota, which is a premier research institute. And there's a report that indicates that the research spending, the research activity that's going on at the University of Minnesota is dropping off, and that's a place where, you know, research results are transferable. If something happens, somebody discovers something at University of California, you can read about it in a journal and you can do something about it, but you're a year behind. You're, you know, 18 months behind. You're not right on the fringe, and so there's always this advantage, the short-term advantage in terms of economic activity from having homegrown research in there. And then, of course, there are some types of research that wouldn't be done outside the state, cold weather crops, for example, or something like that. So that's an area where looking a little longer term, and as I said in response to Senator Cohen's question, there's not a lot you can do in the very short term in terms of, you know, what can we do next month or for next year, but setting the stage for 2020 or 2030 or whatever, those are kind of the kinds of things that you can do, I think.
Thank you.
Further questions for Dr. Stinson? Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, this might not be for Dr. Stinson, but so that I don't forget. On page one, well, not page one, the back of the second page, where we break down the revenue by tax category, income tax, sales tax, corporate income tax, motor vehicle tax, and whichever one of you has the expertise can answer for me, under motor vehicle sales tax, as long as that's all now going to highways, the $4 million deviation here, is that on sales tax on leased vehicles, or why are we tracking that? What does it mean?
Mr. Chairman, I can answer that question. All of the motor vehicle sales tax is not now going to highways. That's a phased transition, and so this is the general fund portion of the change, not the total amount, okay, but the general fund portion of the change.
That's very good. I understand. And other revenues, Dr. Stinson? I'm just wondering, are we counting here with this revenue page all revenues that come to the state, fees and other revenue streams, or what's under the other revenue category?
Mr. Chairman, the other revenues are all other general fund revenues, but, for example, the gasoline tax would not be counted in there. So fees are counted, things like the deed tax, the mortgage tax, the estate tax, the tobacco settlement payments, lottery revenues, those kinds of things are all counted in that other revenue. Investment income is another item that's counted in there.
Dr. Stinson, I better follow up on that. if the motor vehicle sales tax revenues not currently covered by the MVIS transfer of $4 million, maybe it's a question directly to Mr.
Did anybody ask about these inflation numbers?
I thought the leased vehicle portion of that was significantly greater. In terms of what's right. Requested in the governor's budget relative to conversion of the leased vehicle portion to the rest of the MVIS transfer. Is that not included then, or is it only sales?
Mr. Chair, this would be the current law figures, so it would not be adjusted for any proposals in the governor's budget. So this would reflect only the MVIS dedication that was passed by a constitutional amendment this fall.
Other questions for Dr. Stinson?
Chairman, Dr. Stinson, on the inflation numbers, the slide says inflation higher inflation now expected for 9/11. But do I read this right, that there are actually lower inflation numbers being used for 07 and 08? From November? They look lower than what was being used in November. Higher inflation for 9, 10, and 11, but lower for 07 and 08.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Pogamiller, the CPI rate in the November forecast for FY 08 was 2.1. In this forecast for February, it's 2.0.
So it's lower.
But then in 2000, it is in 08. But then when you look at 09, CPI in November.
Boy, keep going.
It's 1.8 versus 2.2 in 09. So it goes up. In the February forecast, it goes up in 09, but down in 08.
But both the 07 and 08 numbers for inflation are lower than were being used in November.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Fogelnauer, looks to me like that's right. And what I think has gone on, I have to confess that I didn't even pay any attention to the fact that the November number looked high there. What I think's gone on is that fourth quarter CPI was down, not didn't increase as much, but actually fell more than was forecast in November. And because of the arithmetic for computing annual averages, that this is what's gone on in there. So I think that's right. I can check this and make sure.
If you would take a look at that, because I just seems curious that the next biennium's inflation projections are lower than the out years. Particularly since we're right, and Commissioner, I just wanted to go over this with you one time. I know Senator Bach and Senator Cohen talked to you about this earlier.
I figured you would ask Senator Pogramiller.
Commissioner, is there a surplus in permanent dollars? I think we all understand there's $1 billion in one-time money. Is there a surplus in permanent dollars over $21 million? Appears to me there's a surplus of $21 million.
Mr. Chairman.
And I was just curious what you think as Finance Commissioner.
I call it a balance of $2.163 billion. If you factor in the CPI rate that we have, that we've outlined in our forecast, it's about $1 billion, or actually the precise number, about $1 billion. $1 billion of that money, of that 2.163, is needed to carry forward the same package of decisions we've made for the 06-07 biennium. The additional 1.1, you could probably call under the CPI rate a surplus.
But it's one time, right? That billion's one time.
The way we, Mr. Chairman, Senator Pogramiller, the way we, and I'm going to reference the governor's budget now, the one-time versus ongoing numbers. What we did was we set a target in the 10 and 11 biennium that we managed to, and then we adjusted our 8 and 9 decisions accordingly, so that we had, in the original governor's recommendations that we announced in January, we had about almost $1.1 billion of money in the out biennium. When you reprice our recommendations and take this forecast into account, that 1.1 drops down to $679 million, while inflation goes up to $1.069 billion under the CPI, or if you take the PGSL, which is also outlined in our forecast, the 08-09 inflation, 08-09 inflation goes up to 1.239, and 10 and 11 goes up to $3.068 billion. So I guess a long way of saying we set an out biennium target and we adjust our numbers in the current biennium and make our decisions and manage to that.
Do you, as Commissioner of Finance, think there's a surplus in the out years in terms of our ability to fund new programs?
We don't have, Mr. Chairman, Senator Pogramiller, we don't have, with the repriced, if you reprice the governor's budget, the balance we have left in 10 and 11 is below the inflation number, the CPI, and the PGSL at this time.
So answer is no.
So.
But comparable to what.
So is that a surplus, or is that, what is that? Think the Star Tribune was right with its headline today that there's a $2.1 billion surplus. As Finance Commissioner, do you think that's correct? Do you think there's a $2.1 billion surplus, Commissioner?
Well, I didn't write that, Mr. Chairman.
No. I'm just asking whether you, as a professional Finance Commissioner, potentially, if you think $2.1 billion is accurate.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Pogramiller, I think we're dancing around. I know what you've said it's very important from November, as we put our budgets together through the governor's budget, and now we have the February forecast, and now you are undergoing the process of setting your targets, that we set expectations with stakeholders and members of the public. I think when you use the word surplus and you don't factor in that inflation and all the pressures, it leads people to believe there's perhaps more money than there is, and there's not. If people believe that we are going to turn the clock back to 2001 or pre-2003, it's not going to happen. If that's what you mean, is there a surplus to do all of that? No. I wouldn't use the term surplus, and if you look in all of our documents that we've released publicly, I don't think you'll find the word surplus, at least the ones
I've
seen.
Thank you, Commissioner. Did you have you calculated the price of government projections yet? Has anybody in the administration calculated price of government projections, where we'll be under the governor's budget?
Commissioner?
Is government going down or up?
Mr. Chair, as Majority Leader, the PGSL figure, as noted in the forecast document, is in the detail for 2010 and 11, is about 2.5% a year. That's a little bit higher than the CPI rate. It's just a different mix of basically goods and services and the estimated growth in those costs going forward. The effect of that on the forecast, if you were to include that on the forecast revenues and for our forecast expenditures, basically would increase the impact of inflation to about a little over $3 billion for 2010 and 11. So whereas under the CPI, you would have a rough balance, actually a little bit more in revenues than spending, even after accounting for the impact of inflation. With a higher inflation rate, that would go into a small, I think, imbalance in 2010 and 11.
I wonder if the administration could, would be possible for finance and taxes to, finance and revenue, to do the calculations that the tax committee often looks at as to what is the price of government. Now, this is something in statute. And I'm just wondering under the governor's budget if it's going down or up, because I remember one of the, during the gubernatorial discussion, one of the candidates, I believe the Independence Party candidate, said that he didn't think it made sense for the price of government to go down when we should be investing. I was just curious, what is actually going on under the governor's budget? Is it going down, or is it going up? That's a factual matter we could just look at some point, if you'd calculate.
Dr. Stinson?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Pogue-Miller, I think that the price of government piece that you're referring to is currently being calculated.
Okay.
We usually release that a day or two after the forecast is released, and so that's being calculated at this point.
Any guess what's going on with it, or should we just wait for the numbers?
My guess would be pretty uninformed.
Thank you, Mr. Okay. Chairman.
Mr. Showalter, did you, or Mr. Hansen?
We had
to. Mr. Showalter, discuss the
spending numbers.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Jim Showalter. I'm the State Budget Director, and I'd like to direct your attention to the next slide in the handouts that is titled A Small Increase in Spending is Driven by Human Services Costs. As we like to say and remind people that the forecast is a forecast of revenues and expenditures, and while we keep a monthly track of what's going on in the revenue side, we also need to take watch of what's going on in the spending side. In this particular forecast, there was a relatively small change in revenues, but it was actually an increase in revenues for 2008 and 2009. That, however, was matched by a small increase in spending for 2008 and 2009, and that's what we'll look at here briefly. The primary mover and cause of the increase in spending is in the Health and Human Services area. You see on this table here, in 2006 and 2007, while there was a $14 million decrease in that area, primarily due to slightly lower enrollment and costs in the medical assistance, elderly and disabled category, and while that continued, it was more than overtaken in growth in costs in the next biennium, resulting in a $91 million increase. The cause of the net increase is primarily due to increased hospital rates that are assumed in this forecast. As of January, higher hospital rates are used for the medical assistance fee-for-service programs, and this forecast includes assumptions as to how that's going to impact our managed care rates as well in the upcoming biennium. The higher hospital rates total about $96 million across programs for the biennium, and it's a phenomenon known as rebasing. In current law, hospital rates are looked at every 2 years, and for additional information on hospital-specific cost information. Those cost reports are then looked at, compared with the rates, and then basically rebased, as the phrase would suggest. Laws in previous years delayed the rebasing for 2 years, so this was actually a look back over a four-year period and actually takes into account information going back all the way to 2002. The increase that is included here affects both the medical assistance programs for family and children, as well as elderly and disabled, as well as the general assistance medical care program. The other major increase in the health and human services area is for general assistance medical care. In that area, we had been assuming a number of enrollees moving from the GAMC program, which is general funded, into the Health Care Access Fund, which and the Minnesota Care Program in particular. While that transition is occurring, the anticipated movement of enrollees is going to be somewhat smaller than previously anticipated, and that results in a net increase in the general fund side of the books of $25 million. Other changes that you see in this forecast include in the K-12 education area, a small reduction in pupil count that continues the trend that we've seen for the last several years, where ADMs have reduced from about 826,000 in 2006, continuing a slide down to about 823,000 in 2009. One small note is that this is actually stops in 2010 and 11. This forecast includes a slight assumption of increased pupils in 2010 and 11. Very small, but nonetheless a small increase there. The result of the pupil counts results in some of the savings that you see in 2006 and 7. In the budget biennium 2008-9, however, increased poverty concentration estimates result in increased compensatory aid spending, about $15.4 million, as well as some increases in state aids for equalized levies. Other changes that you see on the spending side include debt service. In this instance, higher interest rates lead to lower premiums and somewhat increased or lower savings, actually, in this instance, compared to the November forecast, and in all of their spending, a change of $18 million. Referring earlier to Chairman Bach's question about all other revenues, there is included in the all other revenues and all other spending a $24 million change associated with the health and human services area and certified public expenditures. So you see both the revenue and the spending sides are reflecting that for a no net change on the bottom line, but that does make that all other spending number look a little bit big.
Questions for Mr. Showalter?
Chairman, on any of these programs and slides, I have a question about the Minnesota care enrollment trend decrease.
Yes.
Were you going to cover that? Or?
Yes, and Mr. Chair, if I continue, there's two more slides I bring to your attention. The first one is just that medical assistance spending is expected to grow slightly faster in 2008-9, as I referred to earlier. Most of the forecast spending change is in the healthcare area, and you see some of the numbers here. The point that I think I want you to just be aware of is, first of all, that the growth in healthcare, it can be fairly variable, and that while in the last few years we've had a relatively low year-to-year growth in healthcare spending, that is actually going up somewhat in the years to come, and that there's always a possibility of much higher growth as well as much lower growth. This is not particularly unique to Minnesota. This is a similar phenomenon that you would see in other states, similar phenomenon that you would see at looking at federal Medicaid spending as well. The other part of this story is in Minnesota Care. This is in the Health Care Access Fund, not in the general fund, but it's relevant in part because there's actually more expenditures changes in the Health Care Access Fund than there are in the general fund for this forecast. About $100 million in decreased spending anticipated in 07 through 09 in the Health Care Access Fund due to lower enrollment in Minnesota Care, the result of that is lower spending in that fund as well. That increases the amount available in that fund in the forecast, has a balance of about $270 million by 2009. That grows to about $531 million by 2011.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Wallet, why is that occurring? Is it because of changes we made on eligibility or individuals having other insurance?
Mr. Chair, Senator, there's a number of factors behind that. I think there's a good set of questions as to exactly what drives enrollment growth at times, whether it's economics, family, incomes, other options, things like that. But certainly some of the policy choices are certainly driving some of the decreases. We have a health match system that's being developed that will ultimately move about, I think it's 36,000 enrollees from that program into the medical assistance or general assistance. I think it's usually a medical assistance program because they have a better and more appropriate benefit set than they would have gotten through Minnesota Care. So that is part of the factor that's going on here. Also in this forecast, as I mentioned, some of the general assistance medical care enrollees that we have been assuming in the Minnesota Care program are likely to remain in the general assistance medical care program, resulting in a slight decrease here. That being said, the general trend in enrollment in Minnesota Care has not been increasing as quickly as it had been in previous years. And so there are, I think, some policy issues there, as well as some just general decisions that have been made.
Sir. Other questions for Mr. Showalter?
Mr. Chairman. Showalter, did I hear you right when you said in FY 2011 under current law would be a $531 million balance in the health care access account?
Mr. Chair, yes, you heard me correctly. That would be the, based upon the current estimates of enrollment costs in Minnesota Care and the current revenues in that fund will have a significant balances through this period of time. We will be preparing and hopefully delivering a document to you shortly that will include some of the significant direct appropriated non-general funds to give you some idea of some of the things that are going on in those funds. That includes the healthcare access fund, some of the environmental funds, transportation funds, things like that.
Sir Holden.
Commissioner, I just want to go back. You mentioned a few minutes earlier that nowhere in the documents from the Department of Revenue is the word surplus being used.
Yes. I did wonder if you were going to look on the back page.
Well, I knew about that one, but then also I've got the press release here. Communications Director Erin Copeland, she works for the department, I take it. It does say, does use the word surplus.
Senator, where are you looking?
I mean, I think it's fair to call the one-time money, not just so nobody, I think the one-time money at the closing of the books is $1 billion excess.
Yes.
Surplus. Absolutely.
That's the context of the surplus.
Right.
And that's on the back here. You have all your obligations taken care of, all your revenues coming in, and then that's probably the best definition of surplus.
Right. But that, we all agree, that is one-time money, correct? That piece that we would agree you could call surplus is one-time money.
Yes.
Because that's at the closing of the books.
Yes.
For the 07-08, there's $21 million at the bottom line. That's it. If you use the best case scenario of inflation, if you use the government index of inflation,
yes,
you're actually in deficit. Would you agree with that?
Right. If we were... Mr. Chairman.
So there's 21. If you use just CPI, which nobody thinks is really the real number, particularly for human services and other things, you have 21 million permanent money left. If you use something that's more accurate, as former Commissioner of Finance McElroy wanted to use,
PBSL.
Yes. Then you're actually, you don't have that 21 million. You're less. You're in deficit. And so it seems like we agree on that, and so I just is this use of the word surplus here on the 1.013? That's what's at available one time,
yes,
at the close of the biennium,
yes,
of this biennium.
Yes, the biennium that ends.
Right, and so nowhere else is the word surplus being used for what we're going to do in our next budget.
In the context of 08, 09,
correct.
We're ongoing.
Correct. Then we're basically flat line. You're either slightly or 21 to the good if you use a kind of CPI. If you use the government rate of inflation, you're actually a negative number. We're agreeing on that, right?
Yes.
For 08, 09.
If you were to factor in the PGSL, which is
great.
Not always has it been higher than CPI, but the last few years.
It is, yes. So we're hovering. So if we just would agree that we're flat, there's really no money other than unless we don't give somebody inflation in their budget or cut something, there's no money. There's just simply no money. And so if you want to do something new, you need to get new revenue. And there are various ways to get that. You can cut something you're currently doing.
Or you add revenue.
Or you add revenue.
Yeah.
Great. Thank you, Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Pogemiller, I think we agree on what the problem is. I don't think you've even seen, you and I have talked about this. I know the first time we talked about the surplus word in the context and expectations was prior to the release of the governor's budget.
Correct.
I think, and maybe I don't monitor everything the governor says, but I think you will find.
And Commissioner, we totally understand. You can't control what the governor says. We totally understand.
No, I know
that,
but we are trying to manage expectations as well. We're not going to turn the clock back and pay for everything that has been cut for the last 4 years. And if, as I have read the tick list of the wish list that has come out over the last couple of months, in order to meet that tick list, you either have to substantially cut spending that we're already doing or add revenues. I think we're probably at the same place, and now we'll figure out over the next few months how it all turns out.
So, Commissioner, I think based on the conversation we just had, I think both you and I would agree that the headline and the first sentence, a $2.1 billion state budget surplus appeared to remain intact, is just simply not accurate.
I would say, as I've said on the sheet on the last slide, available for budget development. I don't use the word surplus to define the $2.163 billion that's available that we're looking at for.
So if we had the headline writer and the reporter who wrote that first sentence sitting here, they probably would say, well, that wasn't quite accurate based on our conversation just now, it seems to me. What's your sense of that as a professional? Would you have written that sentence if you were the reporter?
It's your hometown paper, Senator.
It is, a paper of record.
They always print from your perspective.
Paper of record. But as a professional, you wouldn't have written that sentence, would you have?
I didn't have it in here.
Right. Thank you.
Just look at my documents. You know, you look at the front page of this. Does it say surplus in context of 08, 09? It doesn't.
Thank you, Commissioner.
They don't listen to me at the Tribune. They might you.
At tomorrow's meeting, we'll have some of the Trib and Pioneer Press reporters testifying. So, Senator Ortman.
In my experience, Mr. Chair, headlines never tell the whole story by their very nature. I think there's more to be told there than the headline. I have a request for Dr. Stinson. As you are working on developing the cost of government, the price of government information for us, could you make sure that you include the federal costs? We often see it broken down in the state taxes or the costs, the burden. And I'm wondering if there's any way you can incorporate at least in one of your slides or one of your pictures when you add in the federal picture as well. So you've got state, county, municipality, as much as possible to get the whole picture, because it seems like, to me, we always look at it and say, well, the price of government is decreasing. Well, not unless you see the whole picture, kind of like the headline. You could say the price of government is decreasing if you look at only one picture, but you got to look at all of them to get a thorough picture, and I think we make a mistake if we don't include the entire picture.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Orton, let me see if I understand what it is that you're asking. You're asking for the ratio of federal government money coming to the state to personal income in the state. Is that what you're asking?
Mr. Chair and Dr. Stinson, we look at these charts that show us the price of government is 15 or 16% of income, but we're looking at the statewide picture, and I'd kind of like to incorporate the price of local government, the municipalities, county, everything that you can include in that picture. Now, you can break it out to show us the statewide picture, but I'd really like to include the federal price as well.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Orton, the 15-16% graph that you're talking about, that's the combined state and local, okay? And now, the question that I have for you is more explicit in this way. There is a difference between federal expenditures in the state and federal revenue that's collected in the state. And the price of government is based on expenditures as opposed to revenues, tax collections. And it's going to give you a quite different picture because the picture is that we send more money to the federal government than we get back. And so that's the reason for the question. And so do you want two pictures as opposed to one? And then if you answer two pictures as opposed to one, which I think you probably will, then the question is, do you want to sort out things like Social Security and Medicare as well so that you see what's going on with Social Security and Medicare and what's going on with other things?
Mr. Chair and Dr. Stinson, I think I'd like to focus on those expenditures, which is a real picture of what's being taken out of Minnesotans' pockets to pay for government. That's what I'd like to see. And how you sort out, I would take your recommendation or defer to you on how best to deal with the Social Security issue within that. But I think that what we really want to focus on are expenditures and make sure that the headlines are as realistic as possible when that report comes out.
Senator Langston. Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is a question for Dr. Stinson. You touched on it a little bit in your presentation, but this week on the national news, they're talking about a possible recession by the end of the year. Do you have enough variables built into your budget to accommodate if we do?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Johnson, no. We don't think there's going to be a recession by the end of the year. I don't think Chairman Greenspan, even though that was how his statement was incorporated, I don't think he thinks there's going to be a recession this year. There's always the chance of a recession because of some geopolitical event, some unknown shock that we know or anything like that. But at this point, the probability of a recession would be very, very small. Global Insight, our forecasting service, has a more pessimistic scenario, but that pessimistic scenario doesn't have a recession. It just has growth rates of less than 1%. Now, that said, the risk to the state revenues is not a risk because of a recession. The risk to state revenues is if instead of having the 3% growth that we have in the forecast for 2008-2009, we only have economic growth at 1.5% or 2%. We'd still be growing, and a recession is actually when the economy shrinks. We'd still be growing, but we'd have a significant shortfall, and that's a concern. And it's a concern because the size of the budget has gotten larger over time, and the size of the reserve hasn't. And so we're still at the same point, really, that we were. We don't have as many tools for managing risk, or as many items for managing risk now as we did prior to the 2001 recession. And so that is a concern. The Council of Economic Advisors is concerned that we haven't increased the size of the. Budget reserve at this point, so that is a concern.
Senator Johnson.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would agree that it is a little soon to be making a media statement like that. And you're right, I think it was a media statement interpretation kind of thing.
Senator Betzel.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, Commissioner Hansen made a comment that he's seen some lists of programs which probably cannot be sustained, I think, given the budget forecast. I don't know what list you've seen, but would that include some of the governor's initiatives?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Betzold, I was just referring to the laundry list of items that everybody, I'm lumping everybody, you know, stakeholders, saying, you know, if you were to add everything up that the governor wants and everybody, we don't have enough going forward. So, I mean, I guess it's a general way of saying we have to prioritize and we can't do everything.
Mr. Chair, and I trust the governor's been advised that some of his initiatives could not be sustained. Is that?
Well, I think what we have, we have introduced a sustainable budget, Senator Betzold, but I am not naive enough to think that it will pass without change in the next few months, that we will sit down with members of this committee and others in prioritize and come out with a joint product, and some of our stuff will follow on the wayside.
Thank you.
Dr. Stinson, could I, at the risk of being a little bit obscure, I was thinking about some of your comments and answers. Let me just go back to that if I can. Did we make a mistake as a state, whether as a state government or as a state, you know, when you were talking about globalization and some of the changes in the economy, did we spend a little bit too much time, maybe in the 80s and 90s, concentrating on a diminishing ag economy and a diminishing manufacturing economy as opposed to looking at where the economy would be in the first part of the century? In terms of medical high tech, that revitalization or other kinds of comparable industries.
Mr. Chairman, it's really hard to pick winners and losers looking out 10 years or 20 years into the future. And we made some good choices and we made some poor choices as a state. One of the good choices that we made as a state was to encourage the medical technology industry. I mean, the market drove that, but we had research activity at the University of Minnesota that helped in that as well. That was a good choice. We made another choice, and that was the supercomputer industry. And we invested a lot in research in the supercomputer industry, and that was a reasonable choice at the time, and it was turned out to be the wrong direction entirely. We made a good choice in the 60s looking at the taconite process and things like that. We've made some bad choices up to this point, at least, trying to figure out what we can do with peat. So it's very hard to make your batting average is not going to be 100% or 1,000 baseball terms in terms of making choices. What that indicates to me is that you need to have a broad portfolio of research activity going on. You need some of it in agriculture. You need some of it in mining. You need some of it in various parts of high tech. In there so that with that broad portfolio, you have some winners and you have some losers, and hopefully the winners are big home run activities like taconite and like medical technology, and that makes up for the difference. And so our record in terms of manufacturing in the state is very good. We have added jobs. We've added manufacturing jobs over a long period of time compared to the U.S. The U.S. manufacturing employment is actually less than it was in 1963. In Minnesota, it's way more. And so, you know, we've been doing the right thing. We were doing the right things. The question is, you know, how do we deal with the situation we're in now so that 20 years from now, people will be able to say we were still doing the right things.
And let me ask a couple of other questions. You talked about the workforce and the educational workforce. Would you suggest then, if we want to look at newer economies, do we put more money you know, we concentrate on, you know, certain areas of the budget, health and human services, K-12. Should we reconcentrate on something like higher education? You know, would we get more bang for the buck if we looked at the higher ed system in the state?
The quality of the workforce, the level of human capital that we have in Minnesota is really important. And there are multiple points of intervention that you've got to have. We have high school graduation rates for minorities that are unacceptable, just purely unacceptable if you're looking out for 10 years or 20 years and the implications for the workforce. Now, how we get those high school graduation rates up to acceptable levels, that's going to be a real challenge. But you can't have high school graduation rates of 60 and 70% and expect to have the state's economy moving forward at a rate that we would expect to be acceptable. So that's a challenge. That's a real challenge, and that's a K-12 challenge. Okay. One of the points that State Demographer Gillespie and I have been making, though, is if you're looking at the quality of the workforce, about 80% of the people that are going to be working 10 years from now are already in the workforce. So we're not going to be able to change the quality of the workforce just by looking at who's coming into the workforce, working on the K-12 people and things like people currently in K-12. We need to have some way of improving the skills of the existing workforce, because the existing workforce is still important and technology is changing. It's making huge changes. So you've got that. And then you've got this whole question about higher education, the role of higher education, and it's not just the University of Minnesota or the four-year institutions. One of the strengths that Minnesota's economy has had has been that years 13 and 14, the community and technical education that people had, you know, that's something that we had a global reputation for. And so there are all of these pieces that are there, and how you fit them together is going to be a great challenge. It is the great challenge for public policy for the next decade.
Okay. Let me just make one final question. Maybe it's more of a comment, but when we've had these discussions, and it's been a real education going to the council meetings over the last several years, when we've had the collection of the group of you or Commissioner Hansen, your predecessors in front of the Finance Committee and I assume the Tax Committee. Last month we had Mr. Kondrowski, Dan Laufenberg. What keeps on coming back, I mean, all the years I've served in the legislature, I think with about five exceptions, to be honest, one of whom just walked in the room, every legislator wants to spend more money, irrespective of party or ideology, and with a few exceptions, five exceptions, I think. And,
that's right.
And yet, what we continue to hear in terms of these last several years, I mean, it's been a little bit of feast or famine. It's not so much that it's a famine, but if we talk about higher education or early childhood or K-12, everybody would admit, well, maybe not, but there seems to be some discussion that the revenues are not keeping up with what might be needed. And it keeps on leading me to a direction that I'm not sure I thought I'd ever articulate, but it's what Mr. Kondrowski talked about from the Finance Committee last month. And I'm not sure any of the three of you would want to comment or take a position, but do we ultimately need to do what Governor Ventura suggested? Expand the sales tax base, lower the sales tax rate, maybe not put as much emphasis on income taxes. I mean, is that the direction we're going if, in fact, we want to get away from this, you know, is this a surplus, is it a deficit, you know, but this continuation of fitting, in terms of the budget, square pegs into round holes? I'm not sure anybody wants to comment, but...
Well, Mr. Chairman, it would be easier for all of us to budget if we had a package of revenues that didn't fluctuate so much with the economy. And I think just from my impression, the sales tax generally, people have to buy items no matter if the economy goes up and down. That's, I think, the chief argument for doing that. Income, of course, fluctuates, is the most fluctuating source of revenue.
Mr. Schulman.
Mr. Chair, if I may add as well, the couple of last slides that I showed on the expenditure side, I think also point to a situation in Minnesota that is experienced in other states where health care tends to grow at something greater than 2 or 3%, tends to grow at 6, 7, 8% on a average year, that our revenue base doesn't tend to grow at that rate, except perhaps for the provider tax. And so the bottom line there is that you have a squeeze in Minnesota as well as other places that is experienced more acutely, so that higher education, K-12 education, and things like that have a declining share of the overall general fund. And so that's also just, I think, a situation. It's not right or wrong. It's just one of the fiscal realities that Minnesota's been experiencing, as have other states going forward. And that's not necessarily I don't have a revenue or spending solution to that, but pointing to the constant pressure, that's part of what's contributing to that as well.
And I only pose the comment, Senator Bach gets to actually pass legislation if we did that.
Well, Mr. Chair, I haven't been here in the legislature for a long time, but in the 5 years that I've been here, I've noticed that there's a lot of really good things we want to do, and it's kind of like our heart is trying to beat up our head, in that we want to invest in education, we want to take care of our grandparents, we want to have a good quality of life, we want to take care of our lakes and our water, we want to take care of environmental issues. And we want to do all of that, but somehow we think that we shouldn't have to pay for it. And so we have these conversations about the needed investments that we need to make. Time and again, I've heard we need to invest in our workforce. We need to invest in our workforce. It affects the businesses who do business here. And then we get stuck, as if like there's a place where we get to where there's a piece of glass, and we clearly see where we need to go, but there's a piece of glass, and we kind of get up there, and we just stand there, and we just look like deers with our, caught in the headlight, as if like we don't know what to do. We know where we want to go, but we don't know what to do because we just don't have the money. And I guess maybe I'm simplistic, but instead of creating this ceiling of saying, well, we don't have the money. Yes, there's all of these things we want to do, but we have a revenue issue. Why don't we just admit it that, we're a state who appreciate all of these things for our citizens, and then say, what if we had the revenue to do all of these things? How much would that take? And then work backwards from that question to say, then what would be manageable? What would be the best way to do it? Instead of saying, yeah, there's all of these things we want, but we can't do it because there's no revenue, and then therefore we must live within our means. And then we keep hearing time and again that, but we need to do, for the future or for our state's future sake, we need to do more, but there's no money, so we shouldn't do. I guess it's no wonder the public is getting a little bit disenchanted with us, because we go out there and we say there are all these things that we really want to do, but at the end of the day, it's just not going to happen because we don't have the money. I just as a new member to the legislature, it's a little bit, maybe I'm still naive and a little bit earnest in that I'd like to be able to do some things. But I don't know. The public out there sees that too. And I guess at the end of the day, it's an issue of whether we have the courage to get outside of the box of that we've boxed ourselves in to say, well, sorry, really like to take care of you, Grandma, but just not going to do it.
Okay. Other comments, questions, discussion for members of the Department of Finance? Okay. Well, Commissioner and Dr. Stinson and Schwalter, thank you for appearing and sharing
all
this with
us. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And the committee is adjourned.